Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I have a very important show on, one I'm looking forward to. I've been reading, as I'm sure all of you have, about our education system and the push that's been really, I think, in overdrive over the past 10 years, that you won't be successful unless you have a four-year degree. And the only stepping stone to financial health and wealth is college. We've been pushed to have people go through an associate's degree and into a four-year college. And I think that we need to take a look at this from a different perspective, because what we're finding is that the people who do go to college may not get a job afterwards, and they're in debt slavery. And it's become, I think, a dividing line in our society. And I wanted to have someone come on to speak about the other side from an education standpoint, somebody who knows what they're talking about. And I think this is going to be a very important show. We're going to have a great conversation. And I want to welcome my guest, Dr. Amber Northern. And she is somebody who can speak to this. Let me give you a little bit about her background. She is a senior vice president for research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, where she supervises the institute's studies and research staff. She's published in the areas of educational accountability, principal leadership, teacher quality, and academic standards, among others. Prior to joining Fordham, she served as senior study director at Westat. In that role, she provided evaluation services for various federal, state, and local educational agencies, as well as oversaw multiple research studies involving reading instruction, math, and science partnerships, in addition to performance-based pay and more. Her work and commentary has been featured in various print and broadcast media, including Fox News, HuffPost Live, NPR, National Review, and Education Next. She serves as the Board of Trustees for Somerset Prep, a charter school in Washington, D.C. She holds a PhD in education policy and evaluation from the University of Virginia, and has an MS in secondary education from Old Dominion University. And she started her career as a high school teacher. So this is somebody who can speak to the education system from the inside. And instead of people, which always happens to us in medicine, we're guilty of having this happen to us as well. People who aren't part of the system speaking at length like they know. And today I wanted to have someone who could really speak to the problem and the hope of what education is supposed to be. And I want to welcome you, Dr. Northern. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
I'm thrilled to be a part of the conversation. So thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So let's start off with, how did you come to this? I mean, you've started from classrooms and seeing what children are, you know, molding them, and now looking at it from a policy standpoint. What made you change that dynamic?
Yeah, I think when I started, ever since I was a child, I wanted to be a teacher. My mom used to joke that I'd line my baby dolls up and I'd have my little ruler and I'd be making sure all my dolls were paying attention and while I was writing on the blackboard. And so I knew that education was just, my dream. And so I was thrilled when I got to teach high school. And I think what I saw is just that kids just rise to high expectations, you know, when we have them. I taught in a variety of different types of schools. And I realized that no matter if kids were in urban schools, suburban schools, if they were white or Hispanic or black or Latino, I mean, you name it, if you just, you know, treated kids like they were capable of high quality work and held high expectations, that they would rise to those expectations. And so I really enjoyed teaching, but I also came to feel like, you know, I could have a potentially greater impact at the policy level, because we know that when you structure smart education policies at various levels, you know, at the federal, state, local level, if they're smart and they incentivize proper, behavior on the part of schools and teachers and even parents, then we have the potential to really increase the quality of education for all kids. So, yeah, I kind of made the turn gradually in my career from teaching in the classroom to trying to develop smart education policies writ large.
Well, I have to say, I totally respect that, because one of the things I went to a very small private school in New York. It was only 13 people in my graduating class. And one of the things, it's tiny for 12 years, right? So one of the things that really molded me was the fact that it didn't matter what color you were. You either did your work or you didn't. And they expected you to do well. You didn't have an option of slacking off, no matter what, who you were in that class. And that set me up for, there's no excuses. You need to work hard. And my teachers were, they were about our success. And I don't think that's, it seems to me, it's not about that anymore. It's about picking out ways to make a, I guess, an excuse why a child can't do. It's not, as opposed to can. It's always about what you can't and what hurdle you have to overcome. And I don't think people really understand psychologically what that means to the child, because they really do internalize it. If I'm expected to succeed, then I know that I'm good enough. I just need to work hard, as opposed to you already have an impediment because of what you look like. And from that standpoint, we're moving now from people saying that you can't succeed unless you do a four-year college degree. But you wrote a really cool article about the value proposition and job skills versus bachelor degrees. And that, to me, set up, answered a lot of questions for me. You don't have to, from what you determined, have to go through this pathway where you go step one to step two. There's a lot of ways to success, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, I think one of the things when I was writing that article, it was actually sort of bouncing ideas off of a study that I had read that basically found that skills that were developed by many workers in lower wage occupations are compatible with the same types of skills that you often need in higher paid jobs. And that's not something that we talk about a lot. So then that implies if some of these skills are transferable from low wage to higher wage jobs, that it's not only about getting an education degree, for example, a typical, you know, 4-year bachelor's degree. But we can also improve our career trajectories if we can suitably communicate and demonstrate that the skills we already have or that we've developed in prior jobs or in prior experiences apply to the same higher paying positions, maybe that we're trying to, go after in our later careers. And so I think, you know, one thing I was just, you know, musing about was that also assumes that employers are open to hiring folks who don't have the standard 4-year degree. And that's a hurdle we can talk about as well. So, you know, if you believe that some of the skills are transferable, you know, that, you know, communication, leadership, organization, you know, you name it, some of these basic interpersonal skills and leadership skills that we often look for, if you think they're transferable to jobs that could be lower paying, but more importantly, higher paying, then you must be open to hiring non-traditional candidates and being able to figure out, you know, how can we assess the fit for this job by something other than just looking at a resume and making sure they have a 4-year degree, because that's often the way that employers, you know, that's their first sort of litmus test, you know, like, okay, let me make sure that they've got this 4-year degree, check. But really, if we think that it's the skills and content and wherewithal and know-how that you have, then we need to actually get a lot smarter about how we recruit and hire folks.
I think that's an excellent point. Let's take a break and have our first break and come back. You're Living in the Solution. Welcome back to Living in the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Northern. And before the break, you made a really excellent point. You don't have, there's lots of ways to get to success. And I think the mindset of high school, college, job is, it seems to be, it's outdated. And if people know that, it gives them a lot more options and they don't, and they can feel like they can achieve. And it's part of it is it's mindset, isn't it? If you think that there's only one way and it doesn't work for you, and not everything works for everybody. Not everybody's going to be a scientist. Not everybody's going to be, you know, a mathematician. Some people are really geared towards things like being an electrician, and that's really important. Quite frankly, it pays quite well. So, I mean, how do we change the mindset of, if you don't have this particular skill set, then you're a failure?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a whole brand of education now called Career and Technical Education, CTE, is the sort of code name. And in some ways, you know, people tend to think of it like, you know, vocational education, which has sort of gotten a bad rap because, frankly, in, you know, 50 years ago or so, it was used to track kids, you know, to say, okay, well, you're not college material, you are. And we, again, to our earlier point of having high expectations for all kids, that's not what was going on. We were lowering the bar for certain kids based on, you know, you name it, their background, their ethnicity, their what their parents did, what we think they were capable of. And so in many ways, you know, that vocational education was, you know, was a bad thing, frankly, for American education. But what we're seeing now is to your point, you know, many people can make a good middle-class living with what we're calling middle skills jobs. And these are jobs that don't require a four-year degree, but require more than a high school degree. There's something in between, you know, whether that's a two-year degree or a technical degree or a certificate. And so, you know, we got to get out of the mindset that either, you know, you have a high school degree or a four-year degree and there's nothing in between that adequately prepares you to make a good living, because it's just not true. So I think we're starting to see, and it's a very slow process, we're starting to see folks embrace career and technical education with the idea that, you know, this specialized training for certain careers and industries and fields can actually set you up for a cutting edge, you know, high performing job with a career potential, and it's not some dead end track that the vocational education used to prepare kids for. So the example I like to use is nursing, because frankly, if you start, if you take some health science classes, let's say in high school, and you begin to kind of get an idea of, okay, this is what the health industry looks like. And then maybe you decide, okay, I don't want to go do a 4-year degree right away, but you get a 2-year degree and you can, you know, get a, be a nursing assistant, and then you can keep going and you can be an RN, and then you can keep going and actually get that 4-year degree and be, you know, I mean, you could be an LPN, then you can be an RN, then you can be a family practitioner. I mean, there's a career trajectory associated with some occupations where kids can see, okay, I can earn a good living, you know, regardless of whether I go all the way to the end of the career track. You know, if I get that 2-year degree, it's still going to set me up pretty well in this particular industry. So I think part of it is just communicating better. And we can talk a little bit more about that, because I'm definitely seeing some initiatives where localities and districts are doing a lot better communicating with kids about, okay, depending on where you think you, you know, want to do, here's a career that can set you up. No matter if you stop on this on-ramp, get off this on-ramp and go off in this direction, you're still going to make a good living.
I think you make an excellent example, because I can speak to it from the opposite side in the healthcare realm. The nurse practitioner or the nursing track has become, they're autonomous in some states. They're running their own clinics. They're making the same amount of money as a physician. So it's become an absolute track to success and economic freedom without having to go through all the money that we spend, like a $100,000, you know, debt that we incur. You can actually get there with a fraction of that. And I mean, the fact that we have so many different career paths that have the same, almost the same endpoint, right? They're not roadblocked anymore. That's very unusual. And from a skills gap standpoint, what is skills gap versus a skills workforce mean? I don't think people really understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about the skills gap, we talk about, you know, what skills, what competencies you need to succeed in a particular job. I mean, I don't think, frankly, the skills gap's a lot wider in certain fields than others. So majors or concentrations, I mean, it matters what you want to be when you grow up, so to speak. So if you're, for instance, skilled with less education in the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, math, which you mentioned before, you're likely to still do better than if you have a 4-year degree in the social sciences. So psychology, anthropology, sociology, and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, where demand for those types of jobs is not as great. So again, that skills gap looks different depending on the field that you're in. And we know that, you know, again, graduates with associate degrees, 2-year degrees, for instance, in electrical engineering, which I think you mentioned earlier. I mean, they have median annual earnings of about $60,000 to $80,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to bachelor's degrees, let's say if you have a bachelor's degree in interior design, which is an example I use a lot, they earn a median salary of about $40,000 to $60,000. So, you know, again, that makes a difference relative to what the skills gap's going to be relative to what industry you're planning on participating in as a worker. And I mean, we know too that associate degrees in nursing, in law enforcement, they also generate very good middle class earnings. So I think, you know, when you're trying to figure out, you know, what kind of preparation do I need to succeed in this particular career field, you're exactly right. You got to figure out, okay, what does the skills gap look like between the preparation I have already under my belt and what I need? And are there some, fields that I can sort of propel into more quickly than others, because again, some of these skills are transferable between these occupations. In other cases, those skills aren't so transferable. And we need to know, to the degree that what we already know and can do transfers into a higher paying field. And if it does, how much more education, training do we need or don't need?
That's a good question. And I think that also, probably you can extrapolate that to people already in the workforce who lost their job. You know, in COVID, I'm sure, is a situation where people are really just, in some cases, floundering. And what do they do next? And the fact that they can think outside the box. Just because you lost your job doesn't mean you don't have the skill set, right? That could transfer mm-hmm. easily into something parallel or even making more money. Is that a way to look at it?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where I think it really comes in. We talked about this earlier, as the folks just, you know, opening their eyes, looking sort of, you know, out of the box solutions. And especially on the employer side, I mean, I think many of us have had the experience, I know that I have in my own job, of looking at, someone, we're in a hiring, cycle, we're trying to hire for a position, I'm looking at this resume, they look great on paper. And then we come in and I realize when I ask them some pretty detailed questions that, you know, relate to what they'd be doing on the job,
mm-hmm.
The answers are pretty superficial, which tells me a lot. And then vice versa, maybe someone didn't have the degree from the highfalutin university. Maybe it was, less prestigious. But they could really, when I answered, ask them some pretty, in-depth questions about what they might be facing in this position, that I'm offering, then they had some great answers. So again, you need to be open to, what you might think would make for an ideal candidate, might have, less to do with their paper qualifications and more to do with their experience and how they can communicate what they already know and how it would apply to a better position for them.
So it sounds like the employer needs to be sophisticated as well. And if you've had a job or you own a company for, you started from the ground up, you pretty much know what a good worker looks like at this point. And being able mm-hmm. to, with knowledge and intention, tease that out of the candidate, I think that, imagine how much better workforce you could have based on the actual person and what they're offering, as opposed to what it looks like on paper.
Right. I mean, there are many in-demand jobs. You know, we talk a lot about, we don't have enough skilled workers to mm-hmm. do X, Y, or Z. We need more, computer programmers. We need more engineers, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be open that some of these in-demand jobs could be filled from the ranks of skilled, hardworking, lower educated workers. Again, to your point of trying to get rid of this stigma of folks that don't have a traditional 4-year degree. And we know that, there are some, there's data that really show that some of these non-traditional candidates could do well in some of these positions. And often it gives them a more expeditious route to upward mobility than going the traditional 4-year degree route. They could enhance their wages much more quickly if they went, for this particular route that might not require a 4-year degree than if they spent 4 years toiling away in college. I mean, don't get me wrong, on average, graduates with 4 years degrees still tend to do better on average, but Again, it's when you get beyond those averages and you look at particular fields and you look at where people are living. We know that, you know, if you have a technical degree in certain places across the country, you can do quite well if the cost of living is low.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing if you're going to live in New York City. It's another thing if you're going to, you know, live somewhere in Kansas or Idaho that's more rural and you don't have to pay that high cost of living.
That's a really good point. You know, I think also life skills versus an academic kind of intellectual approach, you have to learn how to work around problems, and it's real time and you don't get a chance to have a do-over. I mean, there's something to be said of getting out there and taking your lumps in some instances, but learning real time and having that curve of the learning curve, I think, being shorter. Because you actually know, okay, I'm not doing that again. I'm going another route versus something that's totally book learned without any reality associated with it. It's kind of interesting. Right. What's your take on that? Is that a real skill?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's right. Of knowing, you know, I mean, knowing your strengths, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some folks are, you know, have an upward learning curve. I mean, I know, gosh, I think about just taking the SAT, you know, was when I was in high school and, you know, how long I studied for that thing because I just, you know, just wanted to do well on it. And I wasn't a particularly good test taker. And my sister, who, you know, didn't buy one SAT prep book and did great. And so obviously, you know, just knowing like these are particular strengths when it comes to learning or being able to demonstrate what you know is absolutely important, you know, and being able to say, okay, I'm going to invest 6 months or 8 months or a year into getting this credential or getting this training, and that's going to, in the long run, really, really pay off. Versus, I need to spend 4 years and I'm maybe majoring in something that might not pay me that well over the long term or have limited career trajectory or potential to be promoted. I mean, you kind of reflected on this point earlier, but I just want to pull on this thread a little bit more, which is that, you know, we know how many of our high school kids are prepared to go to college. I mean, we've got all kinds of tests that test kids and say, okay, you're ready. Here's your college readiness score. And we know about 1/3 of graduating seniors are ready to go to college, according to the various measures we have. But 2/3 of them actually go, despite that 1/3 are prepared. And then of that 2/3, about half are going to drop out, unfortunately. And that's, you know, that's pretty sobering. So you've got no degree, you've got a lot of debt, and that's a big problem. So, you know, again, if you know, like, okay, there's this particular trade or apprenticeship or technical degree that I can get in this middle skills job that, again, is somewhere in between a high school degree and a four-year degree, and I'm going to do particularly well because these are skills that I already have where I can learn fairly quickly, then that behooves a young person to know that, right? Unfortunately, that's the type of information that's often not at their disposal.
Wow. Well, let's take our second break and think about that, because that's important, that the choice you make initially changes your trajectory, whether you're going to be successful, whether you drop out of society because you didn't make it. There's a lot of consequences for not picking the right thing and having all options available. On that note, let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Amber Northern. And before the break, you made a really important connection that I want to just investigate just a little further. I mean, if children are not, do people actually spend enough time getting to know the child so they can tease these things out? It's an important junction, you know, I guess high school and middle school, to know which way the kid is going, as opposed to pushing everybody into one lump. And no wonder we see dropouts. No wonder we see kids who aren't engaged, who feel badly about themselves and then go another path. Do you think that is also one reason why kids are going off track or using drugs or somehow not engaged?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, when I was in school, it was the job of the high school guidance counselor to try to, you know, talk to kids, figure out what their interests are, give them a little career you know, test, what could you be good in? But that was the extent of it. And frankly, that's just not enough, especially, you know, in today's times. And so, you know, what we're beginning to see, and it's just not enough of this occurring across the country, is that some states are starting to recognize that they need to provide kids with better information. That's not just the high school counselor's job. Many schools don't even have counselors anymore, or guidance counselors. But that they should have, they call them right to know initiatives. And basically it's just like, you know, a guidance that, that gives high schoolers information about here are the states, here are the careers in your state that are in demand, that are promising, that are high paying, you know, that are good careers, mm-hmm. right? And then it gives them, okay, if you're remotely interested in this, here are the average wages. Here, what you normally need in terms of degrees, or if not a traditional degree, the type of training or technical degree or a certificate you might need. And then here's the average cost of what it would cost for you to get that training or education. Mm-hmm. You know, here's the cost of the college. And if you go, if it needs a college degree, here's what it's going to cost to pay back your loan, wow. Your student loan payments. And so kids can make an informed decision. Okay, is this the way I want to go? This is how long it's going to take me. This is how I'm going to, what I'm going to have to pay back. Or hey, I can get this middle skills job over here that pays just as much, and I don't have to, you know, go be in school as long. Maybe I've got responsibilities at home. I'm trying to help my parents out financially, or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. But again, you can make an informed decision, and so. The other thing that some states are doing is they're trying to figure out what a high quality non-degree credential looks like. So if you're not going to get a 2-year or 4-year degree, but you're going to get a certificate or other credential that, you know, certifies that you know something, what are those, what are the highest quality credentials that you can get that aren't related to a traditional degree? And so again, having to do with earnings and what it takes to get it. And my larger point is just that, wow, this is just invaluable information for kids in high school to know before they make these huge decisions about whether they're going to go to college and what they're going to major in and this all these other sorts of things. It's happening so haphazardly for kids right now, and it's a real problem.
Well, what do you think the role of the parent is? It seems that the parent is taking pretty much a back step in the education of their children. And I really got a flavor for this during this COVID lockdown and reopening of the schools. Have you heard that some of these, some of the teachers and schools do not want the parents in the room when the kids are right. doing their studies? I find that concerning, frankly. What's your take mm-hmm. on that?
Yeah, I've seen the same thing, and it's pretty ludicrous, right? If anything, this should be a time where we should be really grateful that parents get a more bird's eye, you know, in-depth look at what's going on in school so they can support their kids better. And so absolutely, I mean, you know, I know it's been such a challenge, obviously, for working parents, which are many, mm-hmm. to, you know, try to help their kids and come along and support them. But absolutely. I mean, if we have complained, oh my gosh, when I was a high school teacher, I mean, everybody in the teacher's lounge wanted to complain that parents are disengaged. We can't get parents to come to PTA, to parent teacher conference night. You know, they check out after elementary school and then don't care. And I mean, all these things that you hear in teacher's lounges across the country and all the different ways we try to get parents engaged. And here you have this, you know, crazy, you know, COVID thing happen, but in a way, it's honestly instant mechanism by which we can engage parents more substantially and thoughtfully. And I fear that we may lose this opportunity if we don't think about how to harness the natural engagement that's occurring by kids just by virtue of kids learning from home.
Oh, I absolutely agree, and I totally have a different take on that. Growing up. My mom and dad went twice a year to parent teacher conference, and it was interesting. I mean, I had a great time. I wasn't a bad student, but they were right. totally engaged, and there's no black hole where you can, you know, things disappear and you can things that go on in school the parents don't know about. That was never the case. I think that was one of the things that made school and made the whole, it was like a cocoon because there was nothing you could do and you couldn't just, it wasn't like flotsam and jetsam. You actually had someone who cared and the parents knew what was going on. And in our case, the teachers, the parents would back up the teachers. It was never the teacher's the worst person in the world. It's like, what are you doing that the teacher's not happy with? And the kid was on, you know, you have a responsibility. That's also changed, I think. But I guess that's a different conversation where I think students have, I think, a lack of respect for structure and education. And maybe that's part of the problem. You know, they're so engaged in their cell phone and other social media things. And it's not about the future. It's all about what's going on now. And that needs to change. And actually, I have a question that segues into the different types of schools. We, you know, we're homeschooling, there's public school, and there's charter schools. And there's been a lot of angst on the public school teacher side about charter schools. Is there a way you can shed a little light on that? What is the difference between a charter school and a public school?
Yeah, so they're both public schools. A charter school is a public school. The difference is what we call the grand bargain, which is that in exchange for more freedom from restrictions, you know, the traditional public schools often have a mountain of rules and that they have certain number of teachers per student, for instance, certain number of hours per day that you have to have school, certain number of hours that teachers have to plan their lessons. I mean, you can go on and on and on about the reams of rules and, and guidelines that teachers and the traditional schools have to abide by. Mm-hmm. But charter schools get a lot of freedom from those same guidelines in exchange for much heightened accountability. So in other words, they're not going to just stay open forever and ever. If they don't produce outcomes for kids because they've got this enhanced freedom and leeway and flexibility that teachers and the traditional schools often don't have, they're expected to handle that flexibility with some responsibility. And so again, they often get a charter for three, five years, by which time they are supposed to produce results for kids. And in many cases and in many states, of course, the rules change, based on the states, but the idea in most states is that if they don't meet these certain benchmarks and produce positive outcomes for kids, then they get closed down. And so that's sort of the bargain, right? Like mm-hmm. you get enhanced flexibility in turn for results. And so many parents have, you know, been quite enamored by charter schools and having choices for their kids. And so they've been probably the most important innovation we've had in K-12 education. In my opinion, since I've been in education, it's the biggest innovation we've had.
And when you look at them statistically, do the children do better in those type of environments versus the general public school?
Yeah. So it varies, right? What we found mainly is that the charter schools located in cities, so in urban areas, tend to outperform similar schools in those same cities. So it's pretty clear. The research is pretty clear when you're comparing apples to apples in a city. So, you know, high poverty, mm-hmm. disadvantaged kids who, you know, maybe would not have excelled in a traditional school are often going to charter schools in the same city. And we're seeing them do remarkably better than they did in the traditional school. So the track record for charters in suburban areas is less positive. We often see that they do about as well as traditional schools. So the takeaway here for us in education has been that charter schools do particularly well for poorer kids in the cities.
Well, that says a lot since that's the group of kids who I think they're under more duress and success it's harder to come by. But it's not, to me, it's not because they can't. It's because of the opportunity and the environment that they're in. And correct me if I'm wrong, but if the charter schools have all of this leeway, I think to me, it seems the mindset would be, you're here, we're going to have you succeed. I don't care what you look like. First of all, they have a dog in the hunt because they're going to close down if they don't have successful kids. So to me, there's a movement. Everybody pulling together because everybody stands to gain. That doesn't seem to be the same in the public school system alone. Because they're going to get their money no matter what, right?
Right. I mean, I think that's right. When you've got this, you know, you're under the gun to perform and do well quickly, that's obviously incentivizes a school, and it makes for hiring like-minded people, mm-hmm. right? So that's another thing. You know, that's a huge advantage, frankly, in the charter system, is that they have more hiring freedom and firing freedom than traditional public schools, because, you know, you're going to work, typically you're going to work longer hours in charter schools. There's going to be a lot more expected of you. And so, you know, every teacher is not going to sign up to work in a poverty school in a disadvantaged area because it's hard work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're naturally kind of attracting teachers who are, you know, in it to help the kids who, you know, need a high quality education the most. And you're going to be willing to put in those long hours. And so, yeah, you definitely attract a different type of staff member, frankly, often younger people without families, to be honest, that take a turn in charter schools and really give it their all. And they know that they're not going to be there for 10 or 12 years, but the time that they're there, you know, they're going to really bust their butts.
Imagine all the children that benefit from that. That can change the whole tide of, you know, this class system that we have, because it doesn't matter where you come from. If you have the gumption and you work hard and someone believes that and you start to believe it yourself, then nothing else really can stand in the way. And I can understand now why parents really want this. And I don't really understand why they're being thwarted in some instances. But we can discuss that if you like when we return. You're Living in the Solution. Welcome back to Living in the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Northern. And, you know, before the break, I think I have a better understanding of what the options are. And it's a high stakes game that people are playing. I don't think there's any other way to see that. Just so I can change the conversation just a little bit, can you tell us a bit about the Fordham Institute, what its mission is?
Sure. So we are we're called a think tank in Washington, D.C. We also have offices in Ohio. And our mission is really just to devise high quality options for education policy that does the good by most kids. So we're not we're not partisan, so to speak. We've got folks on both sides of the aisle that work at Fordham, mm-hmm. And they come together and just as I've said before, you know, what are the best answers for all kids, you know, and oftentimes that means that, you know, we may, you know, side with folks we normally wouldn't side with on particular issues, but we work together for the common goal of doing right by kids. So we do a lot of work around, you know, how do we develop high quality standards for kids? So an example that we work on a lot are academic standards to make sure that, you know, when kids learn math in Ohio, they're held to the same standard if they live in Virginia or whatever other state, that by simply crossing state lines or even districts, that a child doesn't get exposed to a lesser curriculum or a lesser quality of education. And so we spend a lot of time, again, working to help states advocate and develop high quality standards in mathematics and English and history, so that kids get that similar exposure to a rigorous curriculum, and that the rigor doesn't get, you know, tamped down depending on where you live.
And how successful is that? And how much pushback are you getting? Because there are kids who can't read, they're functionally illiterate, they can't do math. And my segue is this No Child Left Behind policy and test taking, among anything else, no critical thinking skills. That's not being taught. It's more social promotion and now social justice warrior stuff. You know, what's your success rate with that? And or I should say, what are you seeing across the country? Is it really apples to apples, or depending on where you are, there's a huge gap?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge gap. I mean, we have what we call the Nation's Report Card, or the NAEP, and it shows, you know, we have test score data from kids, you know, in every state across the country and in most of the big cities across the country. And we see huge gaps, right? Huge gaps in kids by socioeconomic status, by race. And these things, you know, these gaps have been around for a long time. We have seen some movement, especially with the kids in elementary school. But the high school, the older kids, the trend line there has been really flat for a long time on their proficiency levels. We just can't seem to bump up the achievement and the progress of our older students. And so, you know, we see a lot of, you know, banging our head against the wall of how can we innovate more, especially at the middle and high school levels, you know, where these aren't wasted years for kids. And it's a real problem, you know, and I think we need a much more of an openness to innovation in the K-12 sector, particularly at the older grades. And we don't see enough, you know, and like you said, even charter schools, which you would think most people would be in favor of mm-hmm. giving a kid and a family a choice, especially if their local school is performing dismally. But we see, you know, quite a bit of pushback. And that's mainly because, you know, when students leave traditional schools and go to charter schools, then those traditional schools lose funding, right? Because their funding is based on their enrollment. And so if you lose kids, you often lose the dollars that fund that kid, which makes sense. Anyway, we see a big dogfight oftentimes around offering kids more choices.
I mean, it's interesting if this was a business model, then the person who, if you have two businesses competing, they try to one-up each other and get better. It's not like I get mine and let's put the other one out of business because they're giving me too much of competition. This is life we're talking about. I don't even understand that. And teachers, I mean, I wouldn't be a doctor without the teachers who taught me. Nobody who's an adult would be who they are if they didn't have a good teacher. So I would think that everybody who's a teacher, my mom was one, you want your mm-hmm. student to succeed. I don't care if they're public, private, horrible neighborhood, you know, ritzy neighborhood.
Right.
This is what you're put on the earth to do. I can't imagine. And I think I know the answer to this. The morale and how teachers feel, it's just going downhill across the country. But doing the same thing, expecting a different result, doesn't seem to me to be the answer.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the main thing that we're trying to just, you know, really, really push and trying to get people to think closely about is seat time, right? Because now kids are graduated based on Carnegie units, which are basically the amount of time you spend in school. And the whole system is broken. I mean, wouldn't it make much more sense if individual kids could progress at their own rates? You know, some kids are further ahead, some kids are further behind. Mm-hmm. We need to accelerate the learning of the kids who are behind, but we don't need to hold and tamp down the progress of the kids who are zooming ahead. We need to let them keep zooming ahead and not be bored in classrooms because, you know, that's what often happens when kids already know the material. So, but this is, I mean, these are sacred cows when we start talking about how can we, you know, begin to think about dismantling the seat time provisions and letting kids progress and customize education where, you know, education is tailored to what a kid already knows, and we expose them to material that they haven't been exposed to, and we let them keep forging ahead. And that's, you know, I think if anything, you know, we're having this experiment in online education right now, and it's kind of scary for a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. But the hope is that we learn something about how to customize education, particularly online, for kids who have not been able to have that online experience before.
Is there an argument for going, instead of continually innovating, going back to what worked, you know, the old school approach where you write things, you don't have a computer, it's not all spoon-fed to you, you actually have to critically think, and you take politics and everything out. It's like school should be a haven. You're there to learn certain tenets so that you can apply them when you come out. To me, it's like there's this onslaught of society pushing in and telling students how to think. And if you don't think the right way, you're punished. You're ostracized. Some of these teachers come down on you. That's not I hate to say it, but it's almost like an indoctrination camp and not an educational pathway.
Unfortunately, we're starting to see more of that, you know, in K-12. You know, I think for a while, you know, we expected to see more of that, you know, academic freedom at the higher ed level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, professors genuinely have more academic freedom in higher ed. And we expected our K-12 teachers to follow the curriculum, you know, to follow, you know, the lesson plans and the curriculum that they adopted at the school. And we are beginning to see, you know, some of the coloring outside the lines. I mean, the politics starting to, you know, drift into schools. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the main example we saw, you know, over the last couple of years is just, you know, action civics where, you know, teachers are taking off for the day to protest about this, that, or the other. And they're not, you know, they're not in school. So by virtue, the kids are suffering if we've got these, you know, various protests going on. Nothing wrong with protest. This is a free country. Mm-hmm. We're all for the right to protest. But it's different when it's happening on a, you know, a Wednesday afternoon when you're, you know, supposed to be teaching your kids. And so what message does that give to the kids? You know, I mean, again, you know, we want them to learn about, you know, what your rights are as a citizen and how to advocate for what you think is right. Mm-hmm. But we also want them to know both sides of the debate. And sometimes that's what we're not seeing happen. We're seeing more of the activism without, like you said, more of the critical thinking skills where you can analyze the debate from both sides because you've got some unbiased objective information to evaluate, you know, the idea.
I absolutely agree. So what solutions that do you think could be implemented immediately in the short term to start turning this boat around?
Well, I think for kids right now, in this, you know, pandemic season, we've got to start at the basic level. I mean, frankly, right now we don't even know where some kids are. You know, we're struggling with even how to take attendance. Mm-hmm. You know, like, okay, you have to log on at 9 o'clock. Guess what? You have half of the kids in your district not logging on at 9 o'clock. And so, okay, now we're having to have parents, you know, I mean, teachers call parents and try to find out what's going on at home. How come Sally's not logging on? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. unfortunately, where we are now in this pandemic is not where we want to be, right? We just need to be able to, number one, find kids and make sure that they're participating. And then once we can actually just make sure kids are there and they're actively participating, it just becomes a matter of, okay, now how can we just make sure they don't fall too far behind? Because frankly, we know that when kids aren't getting that face-to-face instruction with their teachers, and you just, you know, made a beautiful argument for why we need high quality teachers. But when you're getting less FaceTime with them because, you know, they can only hold so many, you know, live sessions in a day, mm-hmm. You know, it becomes kind of scary that we're going to really lose, a lot of kids through this pandemic because of just the lack of engagement that we're seeing, online at home. So I would say start small right now, just in terms of, you know, making sure we have kids signing in and participating. And then beyond that, I think what it looks like now is just a lot more just, you know, human involvement. You know, we've been hearing from districts, charter schools and districts alike that just having, you know, the teachers and the principals check in with families and say, how are you going? How's it going? What do you need? How can we help you to support your child better during this time? Providing, you know, paper resources, sending things home. You know, in some cases they need meals, frankly, and, you know, in some of these, you know, poorer areas, and because the kids were relying on the meals from home, I mean, from the school. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of looking like Maslow's hierarchy right now in terms of meeting basic needs first, before we can really zoom ahead. I wish I had a more optimistic answer, but that's kind of where we are right now.
Well, I think your answer is important because it makes people start to think about consequences instead of being hunkered down and not, you know, you're so put upon, you don't think. And now it's about getting involved, I think, parents, and making your voices heard and being advocates for your child once again. So in a way, maybe mm-hmm. it's a good thing because parents don't get to sit back anymore. They have to be engaged. And in the few minutes or seconds that we have left, how can people reach you and read your blogs?
Yeah, so we're at the Fordham Institute .org. So that's where we are. We put out a weekly newsletter called The Gadfly every week. And if folks go to the Fordham Institute site, they can sign up for The Gadfly and get our weekly newsletter.
Well, time goes so quickly when you're having fun. Thank you so much for joining me. I learned a lot because it's very close to me. I want our society to succeed. I don't want to see it fall apart. And knowledge is power, and we just can't hope for the best. We actually have to be engaged at this point.
That's right. Thank you for having me as well. Enjoyed it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.